given the huge changes in public opinion over the past 2 years, especially in the heart of Israel's closest ally, the US. So here to speak to me about those changing attitudes, about how that could impact future US policy towards Israel, is Dr. Roy Casagrande, an academic who is extremely familiar with the history of imperialist and colonial movements. Dr. Casagrande, thank you very much for joining Middle East Eye.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder, Roy, what you make of Trump's comment that people are loving Israel again, because just a few weeks ago, we saw Netanyahu talking about Israel becoming a super Sparta that would have to be responsible for its production of weapons and so on. So do you see this growing isolation of Israel over the past 2 years as something reversible if it signs up to this agreement?
So the answer is complicated for two reasons. One, yes, it's true that there's been a shift in the United States. Polls recently have shown that more people in the United States are pro-Palestinian than they are pro-Israeli. And, that's a good sign for sure if you believe that the Palestinians are human beings and deserve not to be genocided. Having said that, the political elite in the United States probably aren't on the verge of budging and going in the direction of believing that. But we're seeing movement like Hollywood actors who have shifted over to the Palestinian cause. I think in the imagination of the average American, especially younger Americans, but we've seen movement even in older generations as well, there's no going back. There's an understanding that what Israel is and what it has done over the last 77 years, and then what it has done, especially the last 2 years, it'll be hard for the average person to go, oh, okay, they're going to do a short-term peace ceasefire, and that makes it better somehow. Also, we know from history, Israel will break this ceasefire in a few weeks, and we'll be back to genocide. And this is a pause in the genocide. It's not the end of it.
Interesting. Yeah, I know you're obviously speaking about growing cynicism of Israel's actions. And we've seen even the groups traditionally close to Israel in the U.S. So if we're talking about Jewish Americans or American Republicans, 61% of American Jews polled think that Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza. We see, Republicans a lot more divided on support for Israel, roughly half having a favorable view of Israel's current government. I wonder then, if these are the kind of numbers coming out of groups traditionally more supportive or sympathetic towards Israel, will future Republican or more conservative presidents have to keep that in mind? We know Trump is very reactive to what his own base is thinking and saying, whether it's Fox News, whether it's previous scandals, which he's been worried about how his base would react. Do you see these shifting numbers as demanding increased responsiveness from U.S. leaders on the subject of Israel?
For Trump, it's impossible to know, right? Because Trump will say one thing one day, and the same day he'll contradict himself, and he'll berate Zelensky, and then he'll praise Zelensky. We don't know which direction he's going to be going in any particular moment. For the average member of the United States Congress, Republican or Democrat, I don't see there being any movement in the next, foreseeable future, next few years. I can't imagine them abandoning Israel. Having said that, Gen Z and millennials have really moved against Zionism. And that's especially true amongst young Jewish Americans. They've come to realize that this is a disaster that's being done in their name, and it's not something that they want done at all. So maybe in a couple of decades after the boomers are gone and the next generation is retired out, maybe we'll finally start to see that kind of momentum that you would need to get something done at the political level in the United States. I don't see anything happening in the immediate future.
It's interesting that you mention Congress. Obviously, in recent years, APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, a lobbying group when it comes to Israel, has aggressively increased its operations in US Congress, but we've also seen a growing number of congresspeople in the US and or congressional candidates saying that they will refuse PAC money, including that of AIPAC. We've seen kind of increasing cynicism towards establishment Democrats like Chuck Schumer, Hakeem Jeffries, and so on, who are traditionally thought to be staunch supporters of Israel, certainly Chuck Schumer. I wonder then, and we saw, you know, two letters signed by congresspeople earlier with the announcement of a two-state solution recognition, and we saw that 47, I think, congresspeople signed letters in support as opposed to just 30 against among Democrats. So is there a growing movement in Congress that is maybe responsive to public opinion and realizing that actually accepting money from pro-Israel lobbies and taking kind of unclear, fuzzy stances on Israel could actually be more of a liability than an asset when it comes to candidacy and campaigning, especially with a view to 2026 midterms and 28 presidential elections?
I really hope you're right. I really hope that is exactly what happens. The reason I don't think it'll happen is I think what they'll do is like Great Britain, right? Great Britain has recognized Palestine and has, you know, thrown in with the rest of the world, and they're still sending weapons and money to Israel. That it's, you know, we're going to pretend we're doing something, but to placate our own public, but in reality, nothing has changed. It's the same old policies. And I feel like that's what's going to happen with these members of Congress. They might say the right thing to appeal to Gen Z and millennials as they start to vote more and more. But in reality, at least in the immediate future, I don't see a change. But I'm hoping I'm wrong, and I'm hoping you're right, and that we are going to see major changes.
Thank you. I often hope I'm right too, but just on that on that note, you're obviously speaking in terms of long-term changes. You speak as a historian with a longer view. This moment now that we're in, after 2 years of war, considered by most qualified voices to be a genocide, there are certain images in the minds of people, and you've talked about generational differences. You know, you have an older boomer generation, which, as you've said, looks at Israel and sees the Israel of 1948, right? And then you have the next generation, which sees Israel as that of 1967, not at the state's founding, but in its occupation of historic Palestine. The Israel of 1987, the Israel of the First Intifada. Now, could this be another moment, another differentiating point in history where this generation grows up and does not see the Israel of generations before, but the Israel of 2025? Do you think that that image will look different from the Israel of 1948 and that that could have real repercussions in terms of Israel's image around the world? Do you think the conventional narratives we've heard about the state and its founding are beginning to dampen in the public consciousness so long after that the country's origin story?
Yeah, I definitely think that is happening. So, I can talk anecdotally even about this, where I know people who are boomers or even X generation who had been Zionist, who have shifted away from it, and they're starting to critique Israel, and they're not quite as happy with Israel. And then, of course, if you look at my student body, which are Gen Z, they're fiercely anti-Israel. Like this, they are anti-Zionist. They think the state of Israel is an apartheid state that needs to completely be stopped, and we should definitely stop funding it. We should definitely stop supporting it. Definitely stop sending it weapons. Having said that, I can see how this might long-term lead to a waning support for Israel that might turn into real political change in a few years. I don't think there's going to be anything in the immediate future. Unless, of course, you know, Trump does something really strange, or there's some kind of moment in the American psyche that really shifts the power the balance of power. So in 19 up until 1987, Ronald Reagan had been really strongly resisting jumping in on the anti-apartheid movement with South Africa, right? Because Reagan, at the end of the day, was very obviously a racist. There's no other way to put it. We have a recording of him talking to President Nixon when he was the governor of California, where he refers to African leaders as monkeys. But by 1987, there was so much pressure on Reagan, coming even from his own political party, even from the Republican Party, that Reagan finally did jump onto the anti-apartheid movement, and South Africa almost immediately began secret negotiations with the ANC. Because as soon as that support from the United States went away, there was no way you could sustain the apartheid state. It was finished. That could definitely happen. I just don't think it's going to happen in the next few years. I think it's a decade out, maybe longer. And in part because, for whatever reason, Israel has captured enough of the political apparatus, its imagination, its devotion, its loyalty, that there would have to be a real sea change in a dramatic way. Like having members of Hollywood jump ship, having Gen Z become, do protests, that's all amazing and it's wonderful. It's just, it's, I don't know, I don't see it going in deep enough. Not yet.
And just on that point then, like you said, you need a real sea change shift, and this is definitely a longer term development. But I guess looking more philosophically at it, the root of these US-Israel ties, is this sense of what the narrative is shared values and kind of Israel as this bulwark against Islamism or terrorism or whatever evil from the Middle East that the US purports to be defending itself against. But for this generation, they're perhaps less intimately acquainted with memories of that terrorism and more with endless wars in the name of fighting that terrorism. And there was a lot of fear when Israel began its surprise attack on Iran in June that the US could be sucked into that war. And you had this, immediate defensiveness from very conservative Republicans saying kind of Israel is not to lecture us about getting involved across the world. So I wonder then, could part of that trigger for an American shift be once they sense that Israel is no longer a strategic asset, when they don't have that special military relationship, when they fear that they no longer have the same strategic goals and that instead Israel is becoming a strategic liability, it's dragging them into wars they don't want to get involved in, and actually is disrupting rather than developing the US position in the Middle East? Do you think that's an avenue through which growing opposition might develop through quarters that were previously very, very supportive of Israel, especially kind of in the wake of 9/11 and incidents like that?
Yeah, I can definitely see it. There's plenty of reason for a foreign policy analyst to realize that Israel is a liability to the United States and not an asset. And if you look at the state of the Middle East right now, I mean, think about it from this perspective. The Abraham Accords, a lot of the Arab states that signed onto it got a lot of flak for it. Egypt, of course, is the first Arab state to normalize relations with Israel. They were literally kicked out of League of Arab States for a few years. Jordan has gotten a lot of flak for normalizing relations with Israel as well. So the United States managed to push these Arab states into a position where they normalized relations. And then Israel's response to that was 2 years of unmitigated, nonstop genocide and massacring Gaza. And it just made all those Arab states look like they didn't read the room correctly. That, Israel wasn't on the verge of becoming a member of the Middle East. It was still this, at the end of the day, this genocidal state, hell-bent on wiping out a whole portion of the Arab world. And so it's forced a lot of those states that are strong US allies to rethink things. But then, to make things worse, Israel then attacks Iran, potentially triggering a regional war that the United States could be dragged into, those Arab allies could be dragged into. Israel really strongly encouraged the 2003 war against Iraq. It's one of the reasons why we do it. It pushed Iraq into the Iran camp, which no Arab state wanted to see happen. The United States shouldn't have wanted to see that happen. Israel then, recently just bombed Qatar, which of course then made every single GCC member wonder why the United States is their ally. Qatar is spending, what, $1 billion a year to funding the United States so that the United States will protect it. And then in the same year, they get attacked by Iran and Israel. Like, in what world does that happen where you have this, the US military in your country, and there's nothing stopping Iran and Israel from attacking you? And so I think that a rational actor examining US foreign policy in the Middle East can't help but notice that Israel causes way more harm than it does good for US purposes, right? It is completely a liability. It regularly bombs Syria, it regularly bombs Lebanon. It puts the United States in a position where it's funding. It's like this empty hole. You just keep putting billions and billions of dollars into it. There's no possibility of peace as long as the Palestinian population is stuck in this state of permanent refugee, hell. And yet, the American people have gone along with this. The United States Congress has gone along with this. Every president has gone along with this. So even though there's plenty of evidence, and there has been for decades, for 77 years, I would argue, that Israel is a liability, the United States has loyally plugged along. And for the longest time, the United States had that same loyalty with South Africa. And it was like a little triangle. It was like South Africa, Israel, United States, to the point where Israel and South Africa were making nukes together. And the United States was, blindly turning and, oh, are you making nukes? We didn't, oh, I didn't see that. And, so at the end of the day, I think maybe I'm being pessimistic, but it's going to take more than rationality to push the United States into the direction of doing the right thing.
I wonder then, I wonder how you think the, as you've said, the Gulf states were very shocked by Iran's, by Israel's attack on Iran. How you think the region is viewing this moment? Because obviously, it's completely destroyed their credibility over the past 2 years, their inability to stop this war. It's completely, well, severely undermined their faith in the US's credibility and its ability to create order for many of these Gulf countries that would consider themselves its closest allies. They are now being asked to support a plan which, if it goes well, could rebuild Gaza and provide Palestinian self-determination. If it goes badly, could end up in some kind of protracted occupation, and with no real path forward for Palestinian self-rule. So I wonder, how do you think the region is looking at this moment, looking at get being supportive of the plan, and looking at the threat Israel poses to the region, even after this war in Gaza could come to a permanent close?
So I was actually just in Lebanon a couple of months ago, and while I was there, Israel was bombing. We wanted to go to South Lebanon. We decided it was just too high risk. We did go to the Bekaa Valley, and we were in Beirut, and Israel was bombing the Bekaa Valley in Beirut. And so it was like, this is just sort of normal. We're driving along, and the person I'm with says, "See that bridge there? Yeah, in 2006, the Israelis blew it up." Right. So that's sort of the norm. That is a routine part of Lebanese life, that you're just going to get attacked and bombed. Having said that, I think any rational actor who's a leader in the Middle East, anybody who has any information about the history of Israel knows that this latest peace plan is not going to end in the creation of a two-state solution. It's not going to end in Gaza becoming normalized into the global economy and having human rights. It is Israel's plan to crush Gaza year after year, usually right before an election, so that they can win the next election, right? It's the happy hunting ground for distracting the Israeli public. And it the Thanks for the picture, because it's a good visual. That's the goal. That's Israel's goal. It is to keep Gaza in this permanent state of ruin. They have no intention of letting it come out of this. They are going to use every excuse they can to break the ceasefire in a few weeks, and we'll be right back to where we were. I think the best we can hope for this is just give the Palestinians a break. Like just give them a few days, a few weeks to get food, to get shelter, to store water, to just not be killed, to give birth to babies, like just something so that they can prepare for the next horrific, nightmarish round that we all know is coming. After 77 years, to believe anything else is just purely irrational at this point. We know this isn't going to end in a permanent, long-lasting peace deal. And so I think what there's hope, right? And then there's just we need to give the Palestinians a break. But I think the bottom line, what's really going to be the next steps that the Middle East takes is realizing, like the European Union has, that the United States is no longer a credible and reliable ally. Germany is taking every step it can to replace the United States in NATO. If the Japanese aren't working on making a nuclear weapon right now, they're fools. Just, I think everybody has wrecked Taiwan, needs to figure out, what the next steps are. They need to assume that the United States isn't going to come to their aid. I think the whole world has realized that the US is this irrational, random actor that can't be relied upon. And I just don't know how we replace the US, because in our imagination, right, it's Pax Americana. The United States is the great, what Great Britain was 100 years ago. Like, this is supposed to be a world where order and calm and stability are set up by the US, and all of a sudden the US is out of the picture, and we didn't have time to prepare. We didn't have time to set up the new regime. So
Trump definitely
I think that
accelerated
went
that,
through Arab leaders' minds right now.
Trump definitely accelerating that process, and the region is no doubt due for an extended period of uncertainty and confusion as they try to make sense of both the Palestinians' future and Israel's stature in the region. Dr. Roy Casagrande, thank you so much for speaking to us and for sharing your insights on what this deal means for Gaza, for Israel, and for the region. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me, and I hope I wasn't too glum.
Well, I fear that you are right and I am wrong, but I hope that I am right and you are wrong. So I think remains to be seen. But what Dr. Casagrande was right about was that the Palestinians do desperately deserve a break after 2 years of war, war that has destroyed Gaza's infrastructure and above all their health infrastructure, which I think you, Matilda, can attest to.
Indeed. On today's Extra Long Live show, we are covering the ceasefire deal. So far, the only phase that has been determined, and even that not in full, is the exchange of prisoners by both sides. But lasting and durable peace would be the second phase of the deal, and the rebuilding of Gaza would take not only durable peace, but massive international investment. We have seen cities leveled to the ground, a generation out of schooling, and 90% of Gaza's 2 million-strong population displaced from their homes. And among its most devastated infrastructure is Gaza's healthcare system. At least 94% of all hospitals in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed in what has clearly been a targeted campaign by Israel to destroy the Strip's healthcare system. Some aspects of this, in particular, the bombing of fertility clinics, have been used by an independent UN panel to determine genocidal intent. This targeted bombing of fertility and maternity clinics, as well as the rest of Gaza's healthcare system, has been used as proof of clear genocidal intent to wipe out not just this generation, but a future generation. Now, Mimi Said is an American emergency medicine physician. She has worked in Gaza in August and December last year, and she was turned away this year when she attempted to return in August by Israeli authorities. Mimi, welcome to Middle East Eye. And perhaps to start off, could you just give us an overview of this devastation of the healthcare system that we have been trying to describe?
Yes, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been, in front of us live TV for the last 2 years. We've seen the entire healthcare system be destroyed. When I was there in August last year, I thought to myself, there is no possible way that this could get worse. I went back in August and it was significantly in December and it was significantly worse. When I came back to the United States, it continued to get worse. And I mean, the images I'm seeing now from my colleagues on the ground, it's just unimaginable. Recently there was a request to have incubators sent to North Gaza for preterm infants, and that was denied. Over 50% of the requests that are being made are being denied, and things like baby formula. When I was trying to travel back in August for my third medical mission of this year, and I was carrying so much baby formula, medical supplies, medications that are life-saving. Not to mention the skills that we carry, all of us are being denied. Even the doctors that were previously cleared to go back, they were denied entry. And so, again, this is just another form of destroying the population of Gaza, and it's continuing. The ceasefire deal—that's a whole other deal. That's a whole other can that, unfortunately, I don't have any positive feelings about it at this time, just because Israel has a terrible track record of violating ceasefire agreements.
Perhaps you can elaborate on that, because I suppose one thing that the ceasefire deal should ensure for the healthcare system is a pause, if not a stop, in the daily mass casualty events that have been leveling immense pressure on it, on top of the devastation it has been bombarded with by Israeli attacks, as well. Would perhaps that relief, that cessation in daily mass casualty events, would that not be cause for celebration?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, right? We don't, the less deaths, the better. But as we speak, I just received a message from my medical student telling me she's in Gaza City. They just killed 10 people from across the street from her. They dropped a bomb. And this is after ceasefire has been announced. That has officially been announced at 12 p.m. their time. So will it decrease? Maybe a little bit it will decrease. But, what's important to understand is the healthcare system doesn't magically stand up just because mass casualty incidents stop. There is an entire destruction of the infrastructure of Gaza. So, for example, the roads are destroyed. So, to get aid to the hospitals and to the residential areas, you have to be able to drive that aid in. All of that is destroyed. You do have to stop bombing. That also hasn't stopped. Having things like soap and medications and life-saving treatments available, the healthcare force needs to be reinstated. All of those things are necessary in order to build a healthcare system. Basic things like the proper nutrition, that needs to be reinstated. Clean water. Clean water has been a problem in Gaza before October 7th, but it is so significantly worse now. That is so important to mention because, that's one of those indirect reasons for deaths in Gaza unnecessarily. So those are all things that we need to pay attention to that. Just with a ceasefire, it doesn't just magically come back. Bulldozers to clear the rubble. This is extremely important. We need heavy machinery. We need shelter. Back in March, this was all supposed to happen. There were supposed to be bulldozers allowed in to clear the rubble, a shelter allowed in, a certain number of sheltering units, and all of that was denied. So, we have yet to see whether Israel upholds the agreement on their side to allow all these things.
And I think something you really point to there is that the damage to individuals, the physical and mental health destruction that has been caused, this has been declared by many independent humanitarian organizations, human rights organizations, media outlets like Middle East Eye, a UN panel. This has been called genocidal warfare. That is not just warfare. That means that the damage that has been done is not just for now, it is for the future. The attacks have been designed to cause lasting damage to the bodies and the livelihoods of the people of Gaza. For example, disability. This has been a mass disabling event. A generation has been, I think the highest level of child amputees is now is in Gaza. I was recently on the Global Summit Flotilla reporting for Middle East Eye. This was the flotilla sailing to Gaza. On board, I met a cancer survivor. She told me, "I'm sailing to Gaza because I have been disabled, and what I am seeing in front of me is a mass disabling event." We've also seen fertility clinics and reproductive clinics targeted in what the UN independent panel said was an attempt to try and destroy future generations of Palestinians. Can you talk to us about what you have witnessed in terms of what distinguishes this war as a medic on the front lines to be a genocidal war?
Yeah, exactly. This is not war. This is not the conventional terms of war. This is absolutely one side is not equal to the other side. This is a superpower against, children. This is an attack on children. Children are supposed to be protected. Women and fertility is supposed to be protected. Disabled people are supposed to be protected. Journalists and hospitals are supposed to be protected. It's the exact opposite in Gaza. Those are the people that are targeted. We have seen it over and over again. Mental health is something that has been put on the back burner, unfortunately. And the reason is because you have these explicit, images coming out with children that are beheaded, children that have, loss of limbs, fetuses that have a gunshot wound in their chest. I mean, unimaginable, just nightmares. And so as a result, mental health takes, a backseat. But it is so incredibly important to point out that children having suicidal ideation is not normal by any circumstance. Small children under the age of 5 should not have suicidal ideation. In fact, under the age of 10 is not normal. This is a regular occurrence in Gaza. All of my colleagues and I have witnessed children who no longer want to live. Just think about that for a moment, what the implications are there. The fear that is instilled in these children, drones flying overhead, this is not new. This is not just after October 7th. Drones have been there for decades. Reconnaissance drones doing surveillance, and children are afraid of those drones. I saw children, when I was at Al-Aqsa playing by a tent, and as soon as they heard a drone come near, they ran and they hid inside of a tent because they know what happens when a drone comes near them. It starts to shoot or it drops a bomb. This is something that's innate in children, this inherent fear from birth, because that's what they're used to. So there is just so much more to talk about when we talk about restoring Gaza, but also very important in this, 20-point ceasefire plan that Trump has proposed. Nowhere in there is there a mention of involving Palestinians to rebuild their state. Palestinians are extremely capable of doing so. They are very able to restore their own state, but no one has involved them in that. There are outside international forces that are going to be involved, but no Palestinians. That's extremely important. The IDF has not really made a statement about withdrawing troops. This is kind of left up to them. They specifically say that when they feel safe, they will withdraw from certain areas. They're saying it plain and clear to everybody in the world that they have no plans to withdraw troops or withdraw their forces. So I hate to be a pessimist, but we have to be realistic here and be cautious.